The levels are set. The mics are ready.
Testing, testing, 1, 2, 3.
So strap yourself in. It's time to go one-on-one with Bill Alexander.
Let's go.
Everyone, yours truly, William Eric Alexander. All my friends call me Bill, and welcome to One-on-One with Bill Alexander. Hi, everybody. I hope everything's going fine for you on this beautiful day, no matter where you may be and no matter when you are listening. I'm glad you could join me. Hey, on the phone line, actually, I should say this, on the video feed, I'm still not used to doing video yet. On the video feed, we have a comedian with us today, and we've talked to many comedians over the year. Last week's guest was Anna Vocina, who's also a comedian, but this gentleman is a comedian, and he has written a book, and he's done a podcast, and he's done all this stuff, including teaching a course. So on the video feed right now, we have Scott Edwards. Scott, how are you doing today?
Oh, just so excited. I'm here one-on-one with Bill. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Scott Edwards. Well, thank you. Thank you. That was really unnecessary. Okay, that's enough. And excited to be on with such a high-profile podcaster. Thanks so much for including me with you and your listeners.
Well, I found you a couple weeks back, and I was going over your website and noticed that you've been basically, I think the way you say it is celebrating 40 years on the fringe of show business. So you've been standing on the outside looking in. Is that what I'm getting here?
Well, yes. And you got that exactly right. So one thing I want to correct you on, just so your audience isn't misled, I am not actually a comic. Okay. Some people say I'm funny, but I've been producing comedy events and shows, television and radio, special concerts for over 40 years. And when I say on the fringe of show business, I had all my success and worked with some of the best people in the business. For example, Bill, what do Jay Leno, Ray Romano, Ellen DeGeneres, and Bob Saget have in common? They all work for me. And the reason it's on the fringe is I'm in the hotbed of Hollywood in Sacramento, California. So that's more on the fringe than okay. being in the heart of it.
So you've been doing this for such a long time, as you said, 40 years ago. What got you into it?
Well, that's a great story. And I was pointing to my gray hair. Yes, I'm a much older gentleman and was blessed back in, don't be shocked, anybody, 1980. I opened up my first comedy club. It was the 12th full-time comedy club in the entire U.S. And I was very blessed to hook up with people like Gary Shandling and Bob Saget, Dave Coulier, Dana Carvey, who helped me start that club and really build it to the success it was. I ended up owning three clubs, over 125 employees, and got a chance to work with everybody from the people I just mentioned, all the way to Soupy Sales, Pat Paulson, and Tommy Chong. So just an amazing variety of talent. The short story of how it started was I was a life insurance agent at the quiet age of 20 and didn't like it. And I was on vacation in L.A. My dad, who had a great sense of humor, said, you got to go check out this place called the Comedy Store. There's a little satellite operation by UCLA in Westwood. And I went with my then girlfriend, soon to be wife, soon to be ex-wife. And we had such a great time. And I met Dave Coulier that night. I saw Sandra Bernhardt, met George Wallace. And that was the beginning, the essence of the idea. I came back to Sacramento, quit my job, went bankrupt, and wheeled and dealed my way into my first club.
So I've talked to actually many comedians who talk about their first days and working in these types of clubs. One of them is actually celebrating his 40th year as a comedy coach by the name of Neil Lieberman, who I spoke to a couple years back. And he said that that was the only place where they could actually break in new material was by being in front of small audiences in clubs like that you had.
Right. It wasn't really a small club. Actually, I had one of the bigger ones. I sat over 200 people.
Okay.
But it goes back to being on the fringe of show business. It's definitely a truism, Bill, that people could come to my clubs and try out new material and not be worried that some producer or director sitting in the audience. So, for example, if you're a young comic and you're coming out from Boston or New York and you're going to LA and you're going to the Comedy Store or the Improv or the Ice House, you have to always present your A material, because there could be some TV producer or investor sitting in the audience that they could pick you for the golden ticket.
Right.
What was great about my clubs, and I had three of them in Sacramento and Stockton, two in Sacramento, one in Stockton, was that they could, I always expected them to entertain the audience, so they had to bring their game, but they could break away from their standard A material and try out new material. For example, one time Gary Shandling, got the audience going, had proven himself, and then said, "Hey, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to be doing the Tonight Show next week, and I'd like to try out some new material." And the audience loves being on the inside, kind of behind the curtain thing. And he literally, off of 3x5 cards, read off about 20 jokes or bits and then gauged the audience. And it was hilarious because most of it was really funny, but also there was a couple clunkers and he goes, "Oh, well, that's important, you know."
A few weeks ago, and I'm reading your information on your website, a few weeks ago, I had the pleasure of seeing Paula Poundstone in Pittsburgh area. And I've been following her for years. And I think it's interesting that the older the comedian gets, the more they start relying on their original material, because that is where they got started. Have you noticed the same thing?
Well, one of the challenges, and that's a great observation, Bill, is that comedy has changed. Not the comics per se, and really not even comedy, but the audiences have changed. It is so much more challenging to go out and entertain this quote unquote woke society, and
yes,
everybody's so sensitive, right? Back in the 80s and 90s, first off, it was like the rock and roll era of comedy, and it was the crucible that so many famous people that we know now, you know, Ray Romano to Dana Carvey, Kevin Nealon, Saturday Night Live, you name it, were able to, fail, able to bomb, and still create and work and build their act. So great story about Paula Poundstone. I was one of the first clubs that she worked, I think the first club that she worked out of her hometown of Boston. She's a Boston girl. She came out, heard about my club. She was an opening act. And Paula Poundstone was the only act in the 20 plus year history of my club that I allowed to work multiple weeks. And the reason was I really liked her and think she had a lot of potential. But quite frankly, she wasn't that funny. Her present, she was quirky and yeah, funny, but her presentation to the audience wasn't that strong. And coincidentally, Gary Shandling was working one of the weeks that she was the opening act. And Gary kind of took her under her wing and helped her. And I worked with her on the presentation of her comedy. And Gary helped her on the writing and the presentation. And by the end of those 3 weeks, she had really honed and learned her material. And then it wasn't soon long after that, she moved to San Francisco and met Robin Williams, and he really helped her develop as an entertainer. And of course, the rest is history. She's done dozens of Tonight Shows and Letterman's and had her own comedy specials, a very successful comedian.
What is interesting, and I'm looking at the, like you said, the golden age of comedy in the 1980s, that a lot of these comedians that you had were, I would say they were, they observed human nature. They were dealing with that and finding what's humorous about human nature and then exploiting it to a point where the audience can relate to it or can laugh at it. And that is not like what we had prior to that, which were just knockdown, fall down jokes. This was more of observation.
Right. And again, a very observant of you, Bill. You seem like you know the business. No, it is so true that before 1980, a lot of comedy was sets at the Hungry Tiger and places like that in San Francisco and in other clubs where comedy was either in the Catskills or it was used as a break between jazz bands or strippers at a strip club. Yeah. It wasn't really an accepted art form. And then several old school comics kind of kept working it. And then it in the late 70s, it really started to develop into an acceptable art form. So by 1980, when I opened, it really was, like I said, I was the 12th club in the country. But by 1985, it was like Starbucks. There was a comedy club in every corner. I mean, it was crazy. Like every disco, because all the discos went away, turned into comedy clubs, right? You know, right. First they were nightclubs, then they were discos, then they became comedy clubs. But what it did is afforded an opportunity for more people to give this unique art form a try. And out of that, we got some great talent. Now, what's interesting is there's several schools of comedy entertainment, but the ones that are the most successful, let's say in my mind, get the golden ticket. To me, that means a TV sitcom or a special or something. And remember, this is before HBO and cable. There was three channels and you had to be clean to get on TV. So observational humor, and probably the two best at it were Jay Leno and Jerry Seinfeld. And guess what? Now they're Jerry and Jay. Everybody right. knows them, right? And it was the fact that they could do observational comedy clean and something, as you pointed out, is so important, relatable by the audience. A quick side story. I did several concerts with Jay Leno, and one of them, the opening act was Yakov Smirnoff. I mean, this was before he was hot with the Ronald Reagan era, but Jay went on stage and did 90 minutes in this concert of straight monology and interacting with the audience. Mm-hmm. It is so hard to do 5 or 10 minutes of comedy. Imagine holding an audience, entertaining an audience for 90 minutes straight. It was incredible to be a part of and see. And there's a reason he's Jay Leno.
I had the opportunity to see him probably around 1985, 86. And it was at a university setting. And I went to the show with my then girlfriend, and we watched him, and he was really new on the scene whenever he came back east. And I was always surprised, and I know you go for the sure thing, that he took the Tonight Show. Because to me, when he did the Tonight Show, he wasn't comfortable in that type of setting.
Oh, but yet, yeah. No, finish your thought, because you're absolutely right.
Because, I mean, of course, you're going to take the sure thing and you're going to follow the legacy of Johnny Carson. But he just seemed very awkward. And there seemed to be more people that could have done the job that did not come from a comedy background, like Letterman, who started in TV, who really wasn't a comedian. He honed his comedian chops on television. And you start looking at everybody else that started in broadcasting before they got into humor.
Well, what interesting about Jay, and you were very correct, the Tonight Show was something he couldn't turn down financially, and it right. was a huge career break for him. But he was never as comfortable on the TV set, the set of the TV show, compared to a stage. And the reason is that on a live stage, he was in control and he could make a mistake or try something new. Once he felt he had the responsibility of the Tonight Show, especially following the amazing legacy of Johnny Carson, he was honed in by what you could do on TV. He wanted to be everybody's favorite person. Mm-hmm. He didn't want to risk anything. And I think all comedy is at its basics, a risk. You're trying to share something in hopes that the audience will relate and respond to it. And he really he did like a 180 and was a different person on the Tonight Show. But what's interesting about that is as soon as he got free from that show, and I mentioned earlier how terrific Jerry Seinfeld and Jay Leno are as stand-ups, guess what? Those are two of a very, very few. I mean, I've known thousands of comics, and these two multi-millionaires have no reason in the world to go out and work. And guess what? Mm-hmm. They're both going out and doing stand-up comedy each and every week. Why? Because they love it.
Right. And I also look at your list. You work with Bob Saget and Dave Coulier, which everybody knows them more from the TV program Full House than they did from their comedy. But Saget, when he started out, he was not the wholesome individual that everybody thinks he is.
Oh, still isn't. yeah, no. I mean, have you seen the movie The Aristocrats?
Yes.
I mean, he Saget has always been filthy. And what a lot of people don't know is he does a lot of musical comedy. In fact, on my website, scottscomedystuff.com, there's a video memorabilia membership site you can go to. And I've got lots of sets of Bob Saget doing music on stage. But boy, don't let your under 15-year-olds watch it, because he is incredibly dirty. By the way, we want to say really funny. We're not saying
right.
He drops F-bombs unnecessarily or something. It's actually smart humor, but it happened to be pretty risque, even back in the 80s and even to this day. What is amazing about Mr. Saget, and I've been so honored to work with him many, many times. He was one of the key people that helped me start my club. I've got video and pictures in my book of him and I working together on one of my early TV commercials for the club. And I consider ourselves friends, even though we're not tight anymore. But back right. then, we spent a lot of time together. And Bob is one of the few people, and I can't really name anybody else, that was able to be totally engaging and funny, but dirty on stage, and then flip a switch, and he was totally clean on Full House, totally clean on Fuller House. He was on America's Funniest Videos, one of the original hosts, and it was a little edgy there, but he was able to transform himself and adjust to that TV clean. And a lot of people, you know, Bobcat Goldthwait, there's been a bunch that struggled with yes. their persona on stage in a live club versus TV.
Yeah. Whenever, and was Saget and Coulier friends before they got the show together, or did that just happen afterwards?
No, actually, Saget got the show and he brought Dave in. Okay. They were very close friends, worked my club many times together. In fact, in my book, there's a picture of us, or on the website, I think you can see it, of the three of us together on my stage for a New Year's show. But quick, funny story that only your audience is going to hear. I haven't shared this before on a podcast. We had had a show. Coulier was the featured act. Saget was the headliner. This is back in late 1980. And the three of us are sitting down after the show, or having a cocktail and just chatting. And all of a sudden, I could see the two of them sharing like a secret laugh. And making each other crack up. And I was left out and I didn't like it.
Right.
And I said, hey, come on, guys, I'm sitting right here. What's the joke? I hope it's not me. And Dave starts howling and pulls up this piece of paper, and folded inside of a piece of paper was some lint from under the table. And Bob had written on there, David, here's some of my pubic hair just for you. So you got to understand, comics, we see so much comedy that,
right.
When we see a funny joke, we don't laugh necessarily out loud. We go, oh, that was good. But what makes us laugh is the totally absurd and bizarre.
Right.
And that was one of those moments where the two of them were just trying to crack each other up.
When I look at the site, you make some, you made a comment on here, or you made a list on here of who's been on. And one whose career has actually gone in a direction where I think she found more comfort doing a daily show was Ellen DeGeneres, because Ellen started in that cookie cutter fashion as a female stand-up comic, had a TV series, ended up coming out to the public that she was gay, doing her stuff there, and then being put on a TV talk show that became a hit that no one, I think, ever thought would last that long, that she was really competing with the time frame that Oprah did her program. So it's really interesting to see that. And when Ellen started, and you've worked with her, did you see that type of that determination in her when she started out?
No, and that's a terrific question that hasn't been asked before, Bill. I can see why one-on-one is so popular. Ellen was interesting to work with. She was, first off, a feature act for me, so she was maybe making $300 for a week of work. She was not standout funny. She was very hilarious, and I would have picked her as kind of the female Jerry Seinfeld at the time, and that's a compliment in that her half-hour set that she was doing for me was very down-to-earth, very relatable. At the time, there was nothing about being gay or anything controversial, and not that that's controversial these days, right. But this is back in the 80s, and she was just really funny, but the answer is no, she didn't seem spectacular at the time. Now, what I think is interesting is that somebody saw that spark in her. And like I said, this was when there was kind of the rock and roll wave of comedy, and people like Seinfeld and Saget were getting TV shows. I think somebody saw her, saw the same thing I did, that she was kind of a female Seinfeld or Leno, very relatable and very funny, and offered her the Ellen TV show and the series. And I think that's where she was actually felt, once she proven herself, she felt free to basically, as you said, come out. And then that kind of made her a celebrity of sorts, that she came out in such a social, open way. And the fact that she ended up being a tremendous talk show host, really, I mean, I think it's amazing. And there was no way for us to see that back in the 80s, but really proud of what she was able to do with her career and her comedy. It's so interesting because I'm part of my podcast, a little plug, stand-up comedy, your host and MC. I've interviewed over 50 of the people that used to work for me, professional entertainers, and many of them took what they learned in stand-up comedy and being live on stage, but were able to direct it to other things, okay. Whether, you know, Ed Solomon is a comedy writer. Peter Galke is a TV comedy writer. I just did an interview with Bob Ettinger, who ended up being a showrunner and one of the important people behind the Jeopardy TV game show. So they take their knowledge that they learned and were able to use it in other ways. Only a real few were able to really stay or go into TV and come back to stand up. And we've already mentioned them, Jerry and Jay,
right.
Bob Saget's back out on the road entertaining, but we're talking four or five comics over how many decades? I mean, it's a pretty rare 1%.
What's also interesting is the list you have up here. Bob Saget, Dave Coulier were on Full House. Gary Shandling had the Gary Shandling Show.
And the Larry Sanders Show.
Gary Sanders Show, I'm sorry. And then Paula Poundstone had a brief TV sitcom that lasted, I think, two episodes, but she was doing her comedy specials that she had for HBO.
Right. Comedy Central and HBO.
Dana Carvey ended up with Saturday Night Live. And then the other ones you show on here, Pat Paulson, which was the eternal political candidate. Soupy Sales was big in children's television and radio. And then Tommy Chong, the great part of Cheech and Chong, who was also on that 70s show. So, again, these people were able to translate a stand-up career, take it into TV, and then go back again. Because I know Dave Coulier is doing stand-up still. He was recently in this area, too. But I think it's really interesting because the way we look at comedy today, we are looking at it online. And comedy, in my opinion, you have to experience it live. You can't get the full effect looking at a computer screen. You can't get a full effect watching a special on HBO. You have to be part of the room, because sometimes those jokes fall flat. But when you're in a room with people, those jokes are hilarious because you're in that unity that you've developed with that audience that you're sitting with. And do you see after COVID and after the pandemic, hopefully we start to see this translate out of here in the next 3, 4, 5 months, whatever it may be. Do you see comedy getting as big as it was before the whole thing happened?
Well, first off, I just want to say congratulations. You hit it right on the nose. Good job, Bill. Stand-up comedy is always better live. In fact, back in the 80s when I had my clubs, Evening at the Improv came out. A lot of people stayed home and watched stand-up comedy on TV. And it took away a bit of our audience for a little bit. But then people realized it's way more personal, way more engaging to see it live. Plus, there's the spontaneity that you never would get in a TV show where Dave Coulier or Dana Carvey might go off interacting with somebody in the audience and creative fun stuff that only happens once is happening, and you're there to experience it and share it. So to all your listeners, if you get a chance, always experience stand-up comedy live at least once. You won't believe the difference, because it's a shared energy in that club or room that you're in. Going to your question, will it come back? I think the answer is yes. However, as I alluded to earlier, we're in a different societal position where, quite frankly, I don't like it. Everybody's overly sensitive. You know, I used to be, it was funny, it was pointed out by a comic in an interview recently that I probably had more stage time than any of those professional comics, because I was on stage 6 nights a week for 21 years. Two shows a night often. And I would talk to the audience and I would warm them up by, you know, picking on Sweater Boy or pointing out somebody's gray hair or, you know, who's married, who's on a first date, normal MC stuff. And these days, everyone's so uptight that if I picked on Sweater Boy, some person 3 tables over might go, "Oh, you might hurt their feelings," you know, and it's just it's a different world. And I think that'll change comedy.
But I think that's interesting, because when you buy that ticket, you should realize that you're working as part of a live event, that you may be the person that is going to be focused on. And I understand that there may be someone in the audience that may be offended. But the thing that gets me is, if you're going to be offended over something that minor, then you shouldn't be there. That's what I think is very that's what I think is very interesting about this, because like I said, 2 weeks ago I saw Paula Poundstone, and she never missed a beat, because she was not only talking about, and again, it wasn't anything political, she was talking about people's careers, and she was asking them questions. There was a guy there that did lighting, and she goes, "Okay, so what lighting have you done?" And he talks about this play that he does, and Paula goes, "So is my lighting right?" And she just goes off on this, and it is hilarious, because she's not taking anything out of the ordinary. She's not misconstruing it. She's dealing with the moment. If an audience member can't understand that, then we have an issue. And I think you're right. I think there are people that are too sensitive.
Well, and you're right again, Bill, that when you buy a ticket to, it'd be like somebody buying a ticket to a boxing match and then saying, "Oh, they're hurting each other," or a football game, and, you know, he's being physically tough. I mean, if you go to a comedy club, no, you don't have to expect to be picked on, but I should say this, and I think your listening audience will agree, stand-up comedy should be and was one of the last bastions of free speech. You could get up and say whatever and hopefully make it funny. And if you insulted somebody, an ethnic group or something, but it was all in fun, it's a joke, You have to be able to accept it that way. And I think what's challenging about today's audience is there's less people to accept the fact that, no, they're not really seriously picking on tall people or fat people.
Right.
It's sharing something that we all see and experience and trying to make it funny. And it's not meant to hurt someone's feelings, but still, it's the certain portion of the audience that's overreading the situation, that's being overly sensitive. And I'm hope, and I think you'd back me up on this, that life is a pendulum. I'm old enough to see things go back and forth. And right now we have the pendulum way up over here. And I think it's starting to come back. People are starting to get tired of the COVID shutdowns. People are tired to get of some of this woke stuff. People, I think, in general are getting tired of the oversensitivity of certain people. And hopefully that pendulum will come back and we can all get back to some essence of normalcy. And that part of that power to getting it back to normal, I think, is stand-up comedy. Like you said, Paula wasn't pulling punches. She's going with the moment. And, I'm sure it was very funny. But if somebody was offended or turned off by it, to me, that's their problem, not the entertainers.
And I also think if you've been following a comedian long enough, you have an idea of what's going to happen at that show.
Oh, right. I mean, you know, if you're going to go see a Bobby Slayton, the bulldog of comedy, or some of these others, that there is comics that have a more aggressive style or more audience interactive. But, you know, it's not a secret. That's who they are. That's their comedy. And, you know, like you said, if you're buying a ticket, buckle up.
Yes. Well, and let's go back even earlier than that. Let's go back in the 1960s and 70s when Red Fox was on the stage.
Oh,
which was, he's not Fred Sanford like everybody thought he was.
No, imagine Red Fox and some of those people in today's community, what they were doing then is social commentary and comedy.
Well,
and
Lenny Bruce, I mean, dealing with Lenny Bruce, even with Richard Pryor, George Carlin, if he was still alive, how would he be reacting to what's going on right now?
Well, what's interesting, you just named four of the people that were the pioneers of stand-up comedy, and they were considered the bad boys of entertainment at the time. But Lenny Bruce got arrested over and over, and guess what? He just went right back and kept doing it, and now he's forever a legend for comedy. George Carlin, the seven deadly words you can't say on TV, you know, they were trying to poke fun at society to get society to laugh at itself and some of its craziness and some of the weird rules and barriers they try to put up to freedom of speech. But what they did allowed for that rock and roll wave of comedy in the 80s. But again, the pendulum has swung back.
Right.
And now we need people to be like Lenny Bruce and George Carlin and get back out there and kind of fight this sensitivity and get people back to, like, hey, we're all in this together. Let's laugh at ourselves.
So if you had the opportunity, and I know you own the clubs, would you rather see a comedian in an arena type situation or in a club type situation?
That's another great question. And I know people love going out to big arenas and seeing a famous entertainer if you have your binoculars, because
yes,
you don't really see them. One thing about stand-up comedy, it is really an art form that's designed for a small stage, an intimate audience. I mean, even at 200 seats, I was able to design my club kind of like a mini arena where everybody had a good view. But I've been in clubs that had 300, 350 seats. And even at that, the people in the back were losing that personal touch. You need the intimacy of a small room to really share the experience and the energy that happens between an audience and an entertainer. And it's not just comedy. I mean, comedy is probably the most relevant to this conversation and something that really leans on that audience participation. But imagine a quartet or a singer or even a dancer that's performing for 100, 200 people versus 10,000. Right. It's just not the same. But it is interesting because a singer and a dancer can come across in a movie or a TV show and you're not going to really lose too much. Mm-hmm. Why? Because they're performing and the audience is just observing. Stand-up comedy is all about that interaction. It really is the only art form where the entertainer, if they don't connect with the audience, there's nothing happening.
So, and again, I'm going back earlier than the 1980s. When you look at this, a lot of these comedians may not have been in the clubs, but they found another medium, which was the whole album vinyl situation where they were releasing stuff that couldn't be sold in front of the store that was sold in brown paper wrappers, such as Red Fox's stuff. But then you had a comedian like Bob Newhart, who did the button down world of Bob Newhart, which is, again, observational and it's hilarious.
Well, even, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but even Bill Cosby, there's a couple examples where there wasn't a club in every corner. It was regulated to jazz clubs and strip clubs. And these guys figured out we need to reach the public without having to go through a stripper, right? And the album comedy was really the way that they were able to reach a mass market before there was a mass market like, you know, TV and stuff that they could do. Right. So, yeah, that's so true. I think some of the great original comedy is what you'll find on the two albums you mentioned and a few others. There wasn't a lot, though. I mean, keep in mind, Bill, that back in those days, there was, 5, 10 entertainers that were trying to get through that ceiling and get to the mass public. And then in the 80s, it went from, maybe 50 working entertainers to thousands, what felt like overnight.
Do you think, and I'm looking at the 1960s right now, that I was very young. I was like 3. But I'm looking back to the 60s and I'm looking at these comedians that were coming out that did not have the club to perform on, but yet they had Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. They had these type of programs. They weren't on for a whole show. They were on for 3 or 4 lines. The audience got a taste for them. And if they liked it, they went and searched for them. Do you feel that the way entertainment is now on TV, that it's too predictable, that you don't have that idea of the daily humor? I mean, Saturday Night Live is great, but it's all skit and it's always their characters that are their comedians they're dealing with, or they have one featured comedian. Do you think if we would go back to something like a Rowan and Martin Laugh-In or whatever it may be from that time period and introduce something like that today, maybe not on TV, maybe on Netflix or on the streaming services, do you feel that that would change the way we looked at comedy?
Yeah. What you're doing is you're able to share and that entertainer with the public. And like you pointed out, the public's able to find the entertainer that relates to them. You know, some people like a certain type of comedy and others like another type. And how are you going to know unless you can sample it? I think one of the biggest changes of the last 20 years versus the 70s, 80s, and 90s was we had all these platforms called talk shows. Yes. The Mike Douglas show, the Tonight Show, or even David Letterman. But, when Jay took over the Tonight Show, he didn't have that many comics on. Mm-hmm. And Letterman had more than him, but it was way less than the old days. You go back to Mike Douglas and some of the other daytime shows, a lot of people were able to cut their teeth and become quote unquote name acts or get some exposure because they could do a 2 or 3 minute bit on a show like that. I mean, Ed Sullivan was the greatest example of a variety show where people had a chance to showcase a talent. And, if the Beatles hadn't done that show, would have there been the Beatles? I mean,
right.
I'm a huge fan. I think they would have push through some way or another. But no one would argue that getting on the Ed Sullivan Show didn't explode them in America.
And that's very true, because and now looking at the female comics, if it wasn't for Sullivan, who would have known who Joan Rivers was? Who would have known who Toadie Fields was? And going through that list, because, again, they were given that 3 minutes of exposure. And Mike Douglas, Merv Griffin, Dick Cavett, these are programs that, unfortunately, the now generations have no clue who they are, because they don't have that out there. The closest you may have had would be Ellen.
Right.
But she's right. Only focusing on herself. She's not focusing on other comedians or
present,
other musicians.
Yeah, she doesn't present comics. But what's interesting is the talk shows today are all about life's drama and who slept with who and who did this to that. And it's just horrible entertainment. I mean, reality TV has been one of the huge downfalls of society in my mind.
I agree.
You bring up a good point. Joan Rivers was one of those early acts that helped break the ceiling and got comedy on the mainstream. A quick side story, if you promise not to tell anybody, Bill.
Okay.
But nobody. I was actually shushed by Joan Rivers. I was at the Comedy Store in Hollywood, and on stage was Gary Shandling. And I was young and immature, and Gary and I had been friends for years, and I knew his act forwards and backwards. And I was in the club with an entourage of women. And, you know, I wasn't really paying attention to Gary's set as I'm sitting in my upfront booth. I'm kind of chatting and trying to feel special in front of the young ladies, like, you know, any jerk guy would do. And it was, I'll never forget. But from around the next booth, I see Joan Rivers come around. And it was like, oh, crap, that was Joan Rivers.
Yeah, if you get shushed by her, you know you did something wrong.
Yeah. That's oh, man, I was funny. Put in my place. So I ended up apologizing to her and to Gary. But it was just one of those moments that will be forever impacted in my mind. I never got a chance to actually work with Joan. She wasn't doing clubs by that stage, but that was my touch of fame with Joan Rivers.
So with all the comedians you worked with over the years, is there any that stand to mind that we may not have mentioned that actually flew under the radar that really didn't get that exposure that these other ones did?
I'm so glad you asked that, Bill. There's actually dozens that made a great living in comedy. Steve Bruner is still out working clean and working funny, working mm-hmm. like Jerry. He just never got the golden ticket. Mark Yaffe's out there doing it. Tim Bador was another clean, very funny guy that got a start at my club and had a good long career in comedy and radio. Will Schreiner, of course, he got his own show, so I guess he doesn't count. But I mean, there's been a lot of them. But I did want to share that the person that I think he actually is famous, but you and I don't know him like, you know, Ray Romano or Ellen, but one of the funniest guys, and I can never say the funniest because I got to work with the best, but one of the funniest that his name doesn't necessarily chip off the tongue is Larry Miller. Now, everybody in your audience, go out and Google Larry Miller and you go, oh, that guy. He's been in over 100 movies. He was the suck up guy in Pretty Woman. He's done stage comedy year after year, very, very funny guy, was one of the funniest guys ever on my stage. But he wasn't a joke teller per se. He would tell stories, a 20-minute story, and have the audience on the floor all the way through it. And even though he's done 100 TV shows and movies, he is not, quote unquote, a one-name famous guy like Seinfeld or Leno. Larry Miller, everybody, check it out.
Well, the funny thing is, I'm looking at him going, oh, that guy. He was on Law and Order SVU. I mean,
he was on the Monk show several times. Hilarious, but a great actor. He always thought of himself. He was a tremendous stand-up comedy. He and Jerry Seinfeld and Mark Schiff were part of the and Paul Reiser were the funniest men in the universe back in New York in the late 70s, early 80s. They had a little club and they're all still very good friends. But and Larry was just a tremendous stand-up comic, but he always saw himself as an actor. In fact, he was one of the few stand-up comics that would put on theatrical makeup to go out and entertain a comedy club audience.
Wow.
And at the time, I thought it was a little strange, but I was young and naive, and he took his art very seriously. And that compulsion to be good is what led to all of his TV and movie experiences.
Because when I've seen him work, I could actually see if he would have focused on comedy, I actually could see him being bigger than Seinfeld, because his delivery is just so deadpan that you're trying to find where the joke is. You know, it's there, but you got to figure out where it's at. And that to me is a thinking man's comic right there.
Yeah, no, you nailed it. He's definitely a strong comedy writer. And if somebody wanted to see his material from back in the 80s and 90s, my membership site through my website, scottscomedystuff.com, has some actual video of these guys, Coulier, Saget, and Miller, and Leno on stage before they were really household names. But hopefully your audience will do the same as you and Google Larry Miller and check him out, because he is one of the funniest people in the universe.
Now, another one I wanted to ask you, if you worked with, did you ever work with Norm Macdonald?
No, actually, I never got the pleasure. In fact, I've not met him. Obviously, I've always been a fan. He has a kind of a deadpan delivery, similar to Kevin Nealon, who wasn't like a joke guy. Kevin worked for me for many years. He was never, I would say, one of the funniest guys on stage, but he always entertained and he was always unique and different. And I think that's why he was a success on Saturday Night Live. Oh, that reminds me, a quick side story, Bill, that you might enjoy. I told you Dana Carvey used to work for me long before he was famous. He was playing the song Chopping Broccoli live on my stage with he and his brother had a band. I could send you the video, but I was actually sitting in a jacuzzi with him on a Thursday night after a show, and he had just gotten the call from Lorne Michaels asking him to fly to New York and try out for Saturday Night Live. And to be there at that moment, he was so excited and so nervous at the same time, because he was a small-time comic out of the Bay Area,
right,
and he had been heard of and seen. And Lorne Michaels called him personally and said, we'd like to see you in New York. And to be able to share that with Dana was just, again, another life-altering moment.
I was going to ask you, did you see the church lady before we saw it on Saturday Night Live?
Yes. Church lady. You know, what a lot of people don't realize is any comic, Seinfeld, Leno, Carvey, Saget, when you see them doing something on TV or on a show, they're not just making that up for the first time. They have worked and honed that comedy bit for months, if not years, to get it exactly right. And the church lady had come out long before Saturday Night Live, just like Chopping Broccoli or the McDonald's Burger King song. I mean, there's several examples of people doing that. Jerry Seinfeld happened to be working, scheduled at my club, when they offered him the Seinfeld Chronicles, which was the official first pilot year for the Seinfeld show. And he was such a professional that after he'd done a year of that show, he knew he owed me a date. He came back and worked for the same money that we had contracted previously and worked my club after he'd gotten that shot on the Seinfeld Chronicles season one of his show. But what's interesting is the Seinfeld show, a lot of the basics, especially the first couple of years, were bits of his that got turned into basically comedy skits, but in the form of a TV sitcom. I mean, a genius writer. And as I mentioned, he's still out performing today because he loves stand-up comedy.
Do you think a show about nothing would make it today?
Well, I would have to say no. my wife is constantly frustrated with the fact that it doesn't seem like there's ever an original thought right. out of Hollywood. Everything's a remake of something else, some to just a ridiculous level. There's exceptions, of course, like Murder in the Building and Ted Lasso, but those aren't even on network. You know, they had to be done right. by other companies. A show about nothing was really people counting the producers. And this was, you know, he ended up being a producer but and the owner of the show. But in the beginning, it was people understanding how good a writer Jerry was. And that, as you pointed out early in this interview, his talent for engaging an audience with totally common, making the total everyday stuff funny. Great example, one of his early bits, and I'm going back to 1981, 82. Jerry was talking to the audience and he goes, "What's with men's pajamas? They're like designed like a suit. There's a breast pocket. I got a collar. I got cuffs. What's that all about?" And it was hilarious because even though probably most of the people in the audience didn't wear pajamas like that, they'd either seen them on Dick Van Dyke or their own dad or That's their right, grandfather. Yeah. And Jerry bringing it out and poking fun at it, everybody could relate to. And how many people could actually, you know, get 2 minutes or 3 minutes of material from men's pajamas?
Exactly. And it was relatable. That's like going back and looking at what Ray Romano did for oh, right. Everybody Loves Raymond. And one of the routines, I just talked to a friend about this the other day, is when he gets back from a trip and leaves the suitcase on the steps because he doesn't want to put it away and his wife doesn't either. And then he throws a tuna fish sandwich into the suitcase because he feels he's getting even with her because he forgot it was his clothes. So it is, it's relatable. It's what we deal with on a daily basis in a lot of our families and a lot of our situations and a lot of our work lives that we do.
Yeah. Well, Ray Romano and the success of his show, Everybody Loves Raymond, is obviously based on his comedy material, which, much like Leno and Seinfeld, was able to be relatable to the audience because it was everyday stuff. Jerry was kind of focused on just life in general, from flying right. to clothes and stuff. Leno was really good at that as well. But Ray, a lot of his material was a lot about family and his unique childhood, and that he brought that on stage in his material, and that's what converted into the TV show. A lot of those early episodes, even though he had a team of comedy writers, were based on his early comedy bits.
And again, I don't think we'll ever see programming like that again, because I don't know if the comedians are the same, if the way it's being presented is the same, but those are classics. From exactly. Seinfeld to even Full House, even to Everybody Loves Raymond, because it was a different time.
Yeah, and life has changed, and comedy is a mirror of life. And what you and I grew up with, I'm a lot older than you, but what we grew up in the 50s and 60s and 70s is a world away
right.
from how kids are growing up in the 90s, I'm sorry, the 2000s, 2010s, 2020s. It's, you know, and that's why things are different.
And it's pretty bad. What I watch on TV now is 40 years old. So that's basically.
Well, me as well, because the classics are, you know, that's one of the, you know, I don't want to take this too long, but what's interesting is the shows that we grew up with, and Dick Van Dyke's a great example. That stuff is still funny today.
Right.
You put on a Dick Van Dyke show to a bunch of 10-year-olds, and they're going to laugh just as hard as we did back in the 60s when that came out. Yeah. I mean, that's the power of quality comedy.
Well, and that's the same thing. The one I was referring to was MASH, because it's still relatable to today's situations.
How funny is it? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
There's one or two we can't show, because All in a Family you could not get away with in 2021.
Yeah, but I mean, I think I was just going to say, MASH is a great example of a TV show that outlasted yes. the war. You know, I mean, what are the odds, right? But that's what comedy, quality comedy writing. But you're right, there are some shows I mean, even Sanford and Son, people would find offensive. And
yes,
they have to remember at the time, it was a breakthrough opportunity to have an all-black family TV sitcom. Yeah. And now they would not look at it that way. They would look at it as a persecution, which is just ridiculous. But anyway, we don't want to get political.
Same thing as Freddie Prinze and Chico and the Man. You would not see that today.
No. You're making fun of the Hispanics. Yeah. No, they were raising up and making the Hispanics part of society in that show. But, you know, again, it's all about the perspective.
So the big question my audience is going to ask is, what does the R stand for?
My name's Robert Scott Edwards. I was named for an uncle that had passed away from a horse accident. But I was Scott was my mom's favorite name. And that's what I was raised at. And it always was so funny back in school. The teachers would get in front of the class and go, Bob. And I was like, who the hell's Bob? Right. I'm Scott. But anyway, I appreciate you having me on, Bill. This has been so much fun. I hope your audience gets a chance. Check out my website, scottscomedystuff.com. Oh, can I tell them about my book?
Yes, please.
Hey, I just came out with a book. You can get it on Amazon. It's available for your Kindle. The actual hard soft copy covers will be available in a couple weeks. But you don't have to wait, because you're listening to One-on-One with Bill Alexander. If you email me at scottscomedystuff@gmail.com, that's scottscomedystuff@gmail.com, I'd be happy to send you a free copy of my book, 20 Questions Answered About Being a Stand-Up Comic. And if you have any interest in getting on stage, this will take you from being a open mic amateur to a professional.
Scott, it was a pleasure. I would love to have you back on again, because I'm sure we could do another hour or two without even thinking about it.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. And what's nice, Bill, is that you're really good at what you do. You ask some great questions, and thank you for having me on.
Well, Scott, thank you very much, and I'm glad you were able to join me today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Bye-bye. A big thank you to Scott Edwards for joining me today here One-on-One with Bill Alexander. Had a blast. Had a good time. Hopefully you did too. Please share this with your friends. And again, if you email him, you'll get a free Kindle copy of the book, 20 Questions Answered About Being a Stand-Up Comic, which will be available in paperback on Amazon next month. Also, don't forget to check out his website, which is scottscomedystuff.com. And you'll be able to see a lot of the people he talked about and a lot of the things that he shared with us on the program. So once again, thank you very much to Scott Edwards for joining me today. And I just got word right before this interview that Gilligan, Bob Denver's wife, Dreema, will be joining me here in the near future. So stay tuned. We're going to be talking about Gilligan's Island, all right here on One-on-One with Bill Alexander.